Today, economic dissonance. The DFA Daily to the 8th of May 2021. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, working at this post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I want to look first at the latest job data from the US, which, well, was frankly pretty shocking, and also look at the latest budget announcements here in Australia that are throwing more petrol on the property fire and consider some of the implications. So let's start in the US. This was supposed to be a US jobs report for the ages. 1 million more Americans were expected to be added to non-farm payrolls, and perhaps even 2 million in a sign that the world's largest economy was breaking out of the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, instead, when the dust settled, it looked as if the US labour market had hardly made any stride forwards, and certainly nothing close to the Federal Reserve's benchmark of substantial further progress. US jobs growth significantly undershot forecasts in April, suggesting that difficulty attracting workers is slowing momentum in the labour market and challenging the economic recovery. Payrolls rose just 266,000 from a month earlier, according to the Labour Department report. And it represented one of the largest downside misses on record. Various people were expecting at least 1 million, so that's a massive miss. The unemployment rate edged up to 6.1%, though the labour force participation rate also did increase. The report stunned investors as Treasury yields plunged. The benchmark 10-year yield dropped by more than 10 basis points to 1.464%. That's the lowest in more than 2 months before, just moving up slightly later. The dollar turned sharply lower. And yet, US stocks rose on expectations that monetary policy will remain conducive to economic growth for a sustained period. The Dow rose 0.66%. to end the day at a record close of 34,777. The S&P 500 was up 0.74% to close at a record of 4,232, and the Nasdaq gained 0.88%. The euro-dollar market pushed back its pricing for a Federal Reserve rate increase to mid-2023, and the euro-US dollar was down 0.85%, to 1.2166. The volatility index was down 9.24% to 1669, while gold futures for June delivery was up 0.89% to 1831, while crude oil was 0.29% higher to 64.90. And the US dollar futures index was down 0.8% to 90.2. And in passing, Ethereum was up 2.03% to 3,530. And Bitcoin was up 2.39% to 57,557. And finally, Coinbase was up 2.7% to 263.70. With the Fed's ongoing narrative of lower for longer rate environment strengthened, tech stocks moved higher as fears of a rapid pace of inflation and an overheating eased. Google parent Alphabet, Microsoft, Facebook, and Apple all ended higher, although Amazon closed a little lower. The disappointing payroll print leaves overall employment more than 8 million short of its pre-pandemic level and is consistent with recent comments from company officials highlighting challenges in filling open positions. It's a lot faster to lay off workers than it is to hire them back, said Sarah House, a senior economist at Wells Fargo. While we are seeing some workers coming back into the labour force, it isn't just fast enough. While job gains accelerated in leisure and hospitality, employment at temporary help agencies and transportation and warehousing declined sharply. Fed Chair Jerome Powell said last week that the dichotomy between the large number of unfilled positions and millions of unemployed likely reflects a combination of a skills gap, childcare obligations, and lingering virus fears, although some will argue that the handouts didn't help. Massive fiscal stimulus, including the latest $1.9 trillion package passed by President Joe Biden in March, may also be impacting the pace of job growth. Some firms indicated enhanced unemployment benefits, and the latest round of pandemic relief checks are indeed discouraging a return to work, even as job openings approached a record. Minneapolis Fed President Neel Kashkari said the data justified why the Fed is continuing to deliver its own stimulus. Today's job report is just one more example to show that we have a long way to go and we should not prematurely declare victory, he said. On an unadjusted basis, payrolls rose by more than 1 million last month. Seasonal adjustments usually call for a large hiring gain in April, which may in part explain why the headline number fell short of forecasts. Another reason for the more moderate employment gain is problems in the nation's supply chains. For example, motor vehicle production has been severely hampered by shortages of semiconductors. The jobs report showed manufacturing payrolls declined 18,000 in April, driven by a sharp fall in jobs at automakers. Hourly earnings rose 0.7% in April from a month earlier to $30.17. The jobs report showed the wage data for April suggests that the rising demand for labour associated with the recovery from the pandemic may have put upward pressure on wages, the Labour Department said in a statement. A separate measure of compensation that isn't subjected to shifts in industry employment, the Employment Cost Index, rose 0.9% in the first quarter. That was the largest quarterly gain since 2007, according to the Labour Department's data. While the job numbers themselves were certainly disappointing, I think there are a few nuggets in here that are positive developments, House said. Labour force participation, a measure of the percentage of Australians either working or looking for work, rose to 61.7% in April from 61.5%, likely supported by increased vaccinations that helped fuel the reopenings of many retail establishments, restaurants, and leisure-facing businesses. Average weekly hours increased to match the highest on record dating back to 2006, and the gain in the work week, increased pay, and the improvement in hiring helped boost aggregate weekly payrolls 1.2% in April, after a 1.3% gain a month earlier. Workforce participation for men aged 25 to 54 increased last month, while edging lower for women. Women dropped out of the US labour force in April for the first time since January, signalling the jobs recovery may be more haphazard than expected, even as more schools reopen and vaccinations accelerated. Some 165,000 women aged 20 and over withdrew from the labour force, meaning they aren't employed or searching for a job. The total Latina labour force is down 5% since the pandemic began, the biggest shortfall of any of the major race and gender groups tracked by the Department of Labour, followed by black women. Women have seen disproportionate job losses during the pandemic as schools, daycare and elder care closures force many of them to leave work to care for children, elderly parents or sick family members. At the height of pandemic in April last year, the female labour force shrank dramatically, but it has been steadily improving in recent months. Total employment for women aged 20 and over fell in April from the prior month, with Latina and white women seeing the biggest declines. For men and women, the unemployment rate declined for white and Asian workers, while slightly rising for black Americans. Unemployment rates remained unchanged for Hispanic workers of both genders, and the gap between the white and black unemployment widened to the most since November. Black Americans saw a big increase in labour force participation, though, indicating that more workers have returned to the labour market, The rate, which was 61.2, remains the lowest among the major race groups. Now here, of course, in Australia, all eyes are now on the yawn budget on Tuesday. We are getting drip feeds of what's coming, which includes an announcement on a superannuation-style scheme to help first home buyers save for a deposit. And the government says this could be a test case for allowing the use of super to buy a house. Frydenberg told the AFR that although next week's budget will not contain changes allowing the use of super to buy a house, the government has not given up on the idea. We just continue to examine all options. We don't close doors, he said. Tuesday's budget, Frydenberg said, would aim to lock in the economic recovery while guarding against the ongoing pandemic, and it will bolster from $30,000 to $50,000 the maximum amount of voluntary contributions that can be released from the First Home Super Saver Scheme. The scheme, which you may remember was introduced in the 2017-18 budget, allows first home buyers to save by enabling them to make contributions of up to $30,000 to an account with the same tax concessions as super. The scheme is available in addition to superannuation, not as an alternative, but its expansion in the budget and the resultant take-up will be viewed by the government before it decides whether to try and allow super itself to be used for a home, as is being demanded by some backbenchers. The idea was not backed in pre-budget deliberations, partly because it would further overheat an already raging housing market. The government will also add another 10,000 places to the First Home Loan Deposit Scheme, which enables eligible first home buyers to build or buy a new home with no more than a 5% deposit rather than the normal 20%. The government, in partnership with small banks and non-bank lenders, underwrites the remainder of the lender's mortgage insurance through its National Housing Finance and Investment Corporation. While the government has changed its fiscal rules to keep spending to try to drive unemployment below 5%, Frydenberg said, "We're not engaging in a spendathon. We are absolutely focused on targeted support for the economy where it's needed, not undermining the structural integrity of the budget, but capitalising on this historic opportunity to drive the unemployment rate lower," he said. But in an additional move, single parents will be backed to buy their own home with a deposit as modest as 2% under a new housing programme, which will be announced on Tuesday. The programme, which will be known as the Family Home Guarantee, is designed to help single mothers and fathers overcome one of the biggest hurdles to achieving the dream of home ownership. The new Family Home Guarantee for single parents will support up to 10,000 single parents with dependents over 4 years, commencing 1 July 21. But it will help not only first home buyers, but also single parents attending to re-enter the housing market after divorce and family breakdown. Like the existing First Home Loan Deposit Scheme, it will be subject to property price caps that restrict the benefits based on the state where the single parents live. Treasurer Josh Frydenberg told news.com.au, the new policy was designed to address the challenges experienced by single parents trying to enter the housing market. The Morrison government understands the importance of owning your own home and the significant economic and social benefits home ownership provides, he says. The Family Home Guarantee recognises that the challenge of saving a deposit is even harder when you're on a single income while raising children. Housing Minister Michael Sukkar said the policy idea was the product of many months of discussion with banks and single parents over the challenges around getting into the market and securing a home for their family in retirement. I've long been of the view that the challenges for single parent families are not given the prominence they deserve, he said. As Housing Minister, I want to ensure that everyone who aspires for the security and stability of home ownership gets that opportunity. So in developing the Family Home Guarantee, I'm so pleased that more families will be able to realise the dream of home ownership which importantly means more Australian children will be given the additional stability this provides. To be eligible to participate in the Family Home Guarantee, you will need to demonstrate you earn $125,000 or less, but child support payments will be excluded from determining income. Single mothers and fathers will also have to demonstrate they do not currently own property, but they will still be eligible to apply if they have owned property in the past, for example, when they were married. Under the scheme, a minimum of 2% deposit will be required, although a 5% deposit will be required for the new home guarantee, with the government to cover up to 18% of the property purchase price. The sole parent will also need to be the only person listed on the title and the loan. Dependent children will need to be under 16, where the adult is legally responsible for the child's day-to-day care, welfare and development. And children aged 16 to 21 that are wholly or substantially dependent on the other person, as long as the child does not earn more than $6,403 in income in a financial year. Higher price caps apply to the new home guarantee, and the price caps will differ depending on the state where you live. In New South Wales, the price cap is $700,000 for any home in a capital city or regional centre, and $450,000 for the rest of the state. In Victoria, the price cap is $600,000 in Melbourne and regional centres and $375,000 elsewhere across the state. Queenslanders face a $475,000 price cap in Brisbane and $400,000 in smaller towns in the state, and the price cap is $400,000 in Perth, Adelaide and Hobart, and $500,000 in the ACT. It's worth pausing there to realise that that means that most of these will be going to the unit sector rather than the house sector, which is a funny way of helping out the construction sector, who of course are busy building high-rise apartments in our cities and towns, despite the fact there's already oversupply. So this is a backdoor route of further supporting the construction sector. The new measures to help single parents are described as a non-ongoing measure used to stimulate construction, support jobs, and to secure Australia's recovery. So there you have it. They have admitted it, but of course that won't be reported in the mainstream media. For couples and singles, eligibility for the new home scheme does not apply to existing housing stock, and a combined taxable income has to be less than $200,000 in the preceding financial year. There's also an owner-occupied requirement that applicants move into the property from 6 months from the date of settlement and live in the property, so long as your home loan has the new home guarantee. The price caps for the new home guarantee scheme are higher, rising to $950,000 in Sydney and $850,000 in Melbourne. In Brisbane, the price cap for the new home guarantee is $650,000. The price cap in Perth, Adelaide and Hobart will be $550,000. And the majority of applicants for the new home guarantee are younger couples entering the market, with a concentration on those aged 25 to 34 years. Now, of course, the HIA welcomed the moves, no surprise there. Today's announcement, they said, of new support measures aimed at helping families into their own home will make a real difference in the lives of thousands of Australians. Research in 2019 found that 92% of renters aspire to own their own home, yet just 49% of renters felt they would achieve home ownership, HIA Managing Director Graham Wolfe said. The measures introduced over the last 3 years to assist first home buyers, combined with low interest rates, have been incredibly effective in growing the share of first home ownership in Australia to record heights. These new measures will provide ongoing support for households looking to achieve the goal of home ownership. The Family Home Guarantee provides a realistic, targeted and practical way to assist single parents build their family's future. While many people can service a mortgage, saving the extra money each week to build up a deposit is simply too hard. This scheme will meet a real need and support thousands of families gain the security that comes with a home. The announcement of 10,000 new places under the new home guarantee, introduced in last October's budget, is also an important step. Both the First Home Loan Deposit Scheme and the new home guarantee has proven their value in assisting people to buy their first home sooner. Matching the 10,000 places still to open under the deposit scheme from July with a new allocation of 10,000 places under the new home guarantee will help ensure first home buyers can choose to buy either a new home or an existing home. The changes to allow increased access to personal funds placed in a First Home Super Saver account will also provide greater incentive and motivation for young people to start or continue saving a deposit for their first home. Securing housing is a fundamental need for everyone. Having a place to call home helps to build strong communities and allows individuals to build their future life with greater certainty. Or, another way of putting it, more people can get into more debt to help out the economy. And the AFR also discussed how Australia's property obsession warps the economy. They said it's a spectacle that's playing out every Saturday afternoon across the country as large crowds assemble to witness our new national blood sport, the fiercely contested property auction. After a bruising bidding battle, one of the contestants finally delivers the knockout blow by agreeing to pay such an astronomical price that it's out of the reach of the other competitors. So intense is our national obsession with residential property that the value of the country's housing stock has now climbed above the $8 trillion mark for the first time ever. As Eliza Owen, the head of research at CoreLogic, points out, this means that the total value of Australian residential property is now around four times the size of Australian GDP and around $1 trillion more than the combined value of the Australian Securities Exchange, superannuation and commercial real estate stock. So talk about concentration risk. But while property owners may celebrate as rising house prices boost their wealth, the largest surge in real estate prices raises some prickly policy issues, particularly since the surge in property values has been propelled by a rise in household borrowings. With mortgagees now leveraged more than they've ever been, and more than almost everywhere else on earth, that leaves Australia with little room to move when economic conditions change. It entrenches inequality and ultimately creates a question of whether the broader economy is hostage to the housing economy. AMP Capital's chief economist Shane Oliver points out that the household debt-to-income ratio is now running at nearly 200%, which means that it's roughly four times higher than it was 30 years ago. Sidebar there, of course, only one third of households actually borrow, so it's nearer 600%. So far, that hasn't caused us any macroeconomic problems because interest rates are so low and they've been trending down for 30 years. But he adds, there are obvious risks if the interest rate cycle were to change and borrowing costs were to start to rise, or if there were a hit to unemployment. Oliver argues that our huge level of property-related debt means that we're much more sensitive to change in interest rates or even to a tightening in bank lending standards than in the past. And he notes that the prudential regulator APRA sent ripples through the entire economy when it tightened lending standards by introducing a cap on interest-only loans and the growth in investor loans. After APRA tightened lending standards in 2017, house prices fell by 10% on the national basis. And in Sydney, housing prices were down 15%. And you saw the negative wealth effect from falling house prices weigh on retail sales and consumer spending generally. And he argues that high household debt will likely constrain the magnitude of future interest rate rises. High levels of household debt does put a limit on how much the Reserve Bank can raise interest rates and on how much they will need to raise interest rates to cool any future overheating in the economy. That is because the dampening effect on consumer spending will kick in more quickly for a given change in interest rates than in the past, when debt levels are much lower. The rule of thumb, he says, is that if the level of debt to income is four times what it was back in 1990, roughly speaking, interest rate moves are about four times more potent than they were 30 years ago. One of the interesting features of the housing market at present is the shift in those who are bearing the brunt of the debt. Those who already enjoy a perch in the housing market have taken advantage of the sharp decline in interest rates to pay down their mortgages faster, and that means their outstanding debt is being whittled back faster. At the Melbourne-based National Australia Bank, for instance, a staggering 36% of home loan customers are more than 2 years ahead on their repayments, up from 32% a year ago. As NAB boss Ross McEwen told the AFR, the average size of the bank's new home loans have increased by $12,000 in the 6 months to March 2021 compared to a year ago, rising from an average $389,000 to $401,000. But because customers are paying off their home loans at such a rapid clip, the actual balance sheet growth of the banks has not been that strong. Westpac's chief executive, Peter King, agrees. He points out that the average size of home loans has not increased significantly over the last 12 months. What's more, he notes, 72% of Westpac borrowers are ahead on their repayments. But of course, new entrants to the property market haven't been able to take advantage of falling interest rates to get ahead in their payments. They haven't had time to reduce their loan size through principal repayments. As a result, their outstanding debt tends to be higher. For instance, the average size of home loans that Westpac wrote in the 6 months to March 2021 was $367,000. In contrast, the average size of the loans on its book at the end of March was $284,000. According to AMP's Oliver, we're lumbering new entrants into the housing market with an ever high level of debt relative to income. And while it may look affordable because of low interest rates, they're going to be lumbered with that debt for much longer than previous generations were, possibly even into retirement for many. What's more, he notes, higher levels of debt means that they're more vulnerable if something were to go wrong. For instance, if interest rates were to rise significantly in the years ahead. Meanwhile, there's an increasing awareness among policymakers that the benefits of soaring house prices are unevenly spread. In a speech on Thursday, Reserve Bank Deputy Governor Guy DeBell noted that rising house prices heightened concerns in parts of the community, and he added that housing price rises have had distributional consequences, meaning that some people benefit from them while others are disadvantaged. That is certainly an issue that needs to be considered, and there are a number of tools that can be used to address the issue, he said. But DeBell argued that it would be wrong to hike interest rates to subdue the latest house price boom. It's important to remember that while house prices may not rise as fast without the monetary stimulus, unemployment would definitely be materially higher without the monetary stimulus. Unemployment clearly has large and persistent distributional consequences. AMP's Oliver warns that there is a risk that rising house prices could fuel growing resentment among younger generations. For many, many years, housing prices were roughly around three times after-tax income. But starting in the mid-1990s, that ratio began to rise to the point where it's now six times. And in Melbourne and Sydney, the ratio is around 10 times. Oliver points out that this increase is fine for those already in the housing market because they benefit from rising wealth, but it's a problem for future generations and could potentially stir up social tensions. He adds that although Australia doesn't have the same income inequality as, for instance, the United States, we're starting to see more wealth inequality. Baby boomers and Generation Xers are benefiting from rising prices, while younger millennials and Gen Z are being priced out of the market. Still, one surprising feature was the noticeable jump in first home buyers in the past 6 months. Westpac figures show that 13% of home loans went to first home buyers in the 6 months to March 2021. For National Australia Bank, first home buyers accounted for 15% of their loans, but Oliver warns this trend is likely to prove temporary. We've seen the pickup in first home buyer demand, but that will now fall back, partly because the various incentives that were announced in the pandemic had the effect of bringing demand forward. But the other factor is that first home buyers are now getting squeezed out by poor affordability. Rising house prices mean that more young people will be dependent on their parents for help in putting together a home deposit. Figures suggest that the so-called bank of mum and dad are lending, given underwriting record amounts, to help adult children buy their first home. Parental contributions now average more than $90,000. By the way, that's our figures, making the bank of mum and dad the country's ninth biggest mortgage lender. But senior bankers point out that this is only the assistance that first home buyers report, and that the actual level of support could be even higher. That's because well-off parents can easily find a way to slip tens of thousands of dollars to their fortunate offspring, who then claim this money as their own savings. The problem with relying on the bank of mum and dad is that it entrenches inequality. Those with parents are able to provide them with, and their siblings with, tens of thousands of dollars to help them attain the holy grail of home ownership benefit. Those who don't have this parental lender will find it much more difficult. As Oliver points out, not all young people have wealthy parents who can lend them money for their first deposit. It's a growing problem. Indeed, the increasing difficulty faced by first home buyers in saving for a house deposit will likely increase the pressure on Canberra to allow people to use their superannuation savings to put towards a house deposit. Meanwhile, senior bankers believe there's little likelihood that the rise in property prices will abate anytime soon. In the first place, they point out that property investors who have stepped back from the market in the past few years are now beginning to rejoin the house price party. Their renewed interest in housing is no doubt piqued by the widespread expectation that property prices will rise by about 20% by the end of next year. But they also appear to be punting that apartment prices could rise sharply when immigration resumes, particularly given the sharp decline in the construction of new apartments. And it appears that the hankering to become a property investor is fairly widespread. There are about 2.2 million property investors in Australia, or around 20% of Australian householders, and roughly 6% of those investors are aged over 50. According to Westpac, which is the country's biggest lender for investment properties, 64% of their investment property portfolio consists of clients who own one property, 25% own two investment properties, and 7% own three properties. In addition, it's likely that demand for housing will rise as immigration resumes. AMP's Oliver points out that we're experiencing the lowest population growth since 1917, and that has probably reduced the underlying demand for housing stock by, say, 100,000 units a year. But demand will rebound as international borders reopen. Already, senior bankers report house price rises over the past year, particularly at the top end of the market, have been fueled by the return of expats. And they note that despite the latest run-up in prices, it appears that prospective buyers in mainland China, Hong Kong and India still see Australia as being attractively priced. But it is clear that the breathtaking run-up in house prices that we've witnessed this year, with housing price rises of, say, 7.5% in the first 4 months, have been exacerbated by the shortage in supply. Homeowners appear reluctant to put their houses on the market for fear that housing prices are rising too quickly, that they won't be able to achieve the upgrade they're hoping for. As a result, the number of houses advertised for sale is around 25% lower than at this time last year. Westpac's King points out that the issue of supply of homes available for purchase is important at this point in the cycle. Price increases will remain elevated while demand significantly outweighs supply. As supply of housing increases and affordability is impacted, the price increases should moderate. As a result, he argues, we don't believe macroprudential intervention is currently necessary to cool the boom in house prices. But other senior bankers take a different view. Earlier this month, NAB chairman Phil Cronican noted that lending restrictions, known as macroprudential controls, would be a rational response to the current environment. And AMP's Oliver is predicting that APRA will introduce some macroprudential controls sometime in the next 6 months. At present, lending standards are arguably still sound in terms of the way APRA looks at it. And that's reflected in various metrics, such as the growth in household debts compared to income, loan-to-value ratios, and the level of interest-only loans. But historically, the way it always works is that house prices start rising, those metrics then start to deteriorate. We saw a surge of investor lending in March, which swamped the rise in lending to owner-occupiers, and we're likely soon to see a significant rise in LVRs and interest-only lending. And he adds, the surge in investor lending warns that the property market is becoming more speculative. Two quick points on that. Firstly, note, of course, everyone's still talking up more supply, more supply, more supply, when in fact there's a lot of spare properties around and actually more high-rises being built. And secondly, of course, the banks don't want macroprudential because essentially they want to grow their books. The truth is that a lot of the system is skewed towards supporting the banking system and the bank profits, whilst many people just end up paying a lot more and are in debt for a lot longer. And it's also worth thinking about the point that if the borders stay shut for longer, then demand will be weaker. And coming back to that, let's just look at some other signals relating to the budget. More broadly, Frydenberg has revealed that the budget will include a significant increase in the government's $100 billion 10-year infrastructure plan, and confirmed that energy would also be an item. The biggest new spending item in the budget is likely to be well over $10 billion on aged care, which will include the creation of thousands more home care packages, as well as a significant expansion of the aged care workforce. The National Disability Insurance Scheme will cost $26 billion next year and will require an extra $13.2 billion in funding over 3 years. Those changes will be structural, meaning the cost will be baked into the budget over the long term. And Frydenberg says this would offset the savings that have been made by the faster-than-expected economic recovery. Consequently, while the bottom line will be much better in the short term than previously forecast, there will be no speedy return to surplus. In the 9 months to the end of March, the deficit was $133.3 billion, which was $29.5 billion lower than the expected $162.7 billion, which was forecast when the budget was last updated in late December. Frydenberg says the gains from income tax receipts and lower welfare payments due to the rapid rebound in jobs growth would outstrip the revenue boom from iron ore, the price of which surpassed $200 a ton on Friday. In its quarterly statement of monetary policy on Friday, the Reserve Bank of Australia said the economy had snapped back, a term the government abandoned at Easter last year when it feared the recovery would be long and slow. The broad-based nature of the upswing is in line with housing demand being supported by low interest rates, government support programs, a positive outlook for employment, potentially some pent-up demand over the pandemic, and the increase in savings over 2020, the RBA said. And the RBA painted an upbeat economic outlook, noting that households and businesses were adjusting well to the tapering of government stimulus. Household spending, dwelling investment and exports have all contributed to the snapback in activity. Frydenberg said the task of the budget was to lock in those gains while insulating against the ongoing pandemic. More people are in jobs than they were pre-pandemic, with 200,000 more people in work than we thought in MyEFO. GDP is back to where it was 9 months earlier than in MyEFO, and we're coming back in terms of the unemployment rate to where we were pre-recession, 5 times faster than the 1990s. It's just incredibly strong, the recovery, but it's not locked in yet, and that's what we're seeking to do in this budget. And importantly, he confirmed that international borders would remain largely closed to tourists and business travel until well into 2022, and net overseas migration would remain negative. So, standing back, on one hand, you can say everything looks fine, but on the other hand, there are still significant questions. For Australia, of course, demand for property may weaken ahead. The question of the debt leverage is a big one, and many people are being lured in to get ever bigger mortgages, and of course the government budget measures that I discussed earlier will just drive that further. More broadly, in the US, those employment numbers were a bit of a shock, and basically it's signalling there that everybody now thinks it'll be longer before rates go higher. And as a result of that, of course, you've got to expect more asset price inflation. And that's the takeaway, I think, from this, that both here and overseas, we should expect prices in the stock markets and property prices continuing to go higher. Not because they are fundamentally valued right, but simply because of all the stimulation that keeps being thrown at it and the very low interest rates. But given the economic parameters that we're dealing with, that's not going to change anytime soon. So it may well be that we will see more momentum, at least the next few months. And the question is, will there be any policy intent to turn that around, or just let it rip? Given the fact that we have an election within the next 12 months here in Australia, I think we can assume they're going to let it rip. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.